I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to David James, professor of philosophy at the University of Warwick. We're discussing his recent book, Property and Its Forms in Classical German Philosophy, from Cambridge University Press. James works on German idealism and social and political philosophy, especially in the works of Rousseau, Kant, Fichte, Hegel, and Marx. He has written many articles and books on these topics. Well, first of all, David James, welcome back to the Political Theory Review.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be back.
David, I really, really enjoyed this book. It's a great and deep analysis of several important authors in the German philosophical tradition about property, raises all sorts of important philosophical issues that are applicable to today. So congratulations on the book. Let me first of all ask you, what was the motivation for writing the book?
Well, I think there were two main motivations. So one was the existing interest in classical German philosophy, and particularly practical philosophy in this tradition. But I focused on the concept of property because it didn't seem to me that there was really that much written on this topic, not just in relation to classical German philosophy, but also in relation to the concept of property more generally. It seemed to me that a certain way property was just, that there were certain assumptions made about property. The concept of property itself wasn't analyzed. And when it was, it tended to be understood in a specific way. So it was always assumed that private property was intended. So I was able to combine these interests with the book. And I was able to do so because I think the philosophers in question didn't make the same assumptions and tried to develop an account of property which was more intersubjective as well. So there wasn't the kind of Lockean argument where property involves some kind of relation between a person and a thing. One establishes some kind of moral right to a thing. And then relations to others are, in a sense, secondary. Rather, it's as if with the philosophers in the tradition with which I engage, primarily thought of property as some kind of intersubjective relationship. So always, there is a relationship between a person and a thing, but this is always in some sense mediated by a relation between persons. So I thought that was quite distinctive and a helpful way of understanding property that's relevant today.
Yes, I very much like that framing, because I think a lot of us are sort of think about the basis of property in roughly Lockean terms. That is, as you put it, a relationship between the individual and the world, or the things in the world, particularly as Locke's famous account that we mix our labor with the things of the world and then it becomes ours. And this is like very influential argument that comes down into liberal theory, including Nozick, whom you discussed in the introduction. So maybe that's a helpful place to start. I mean, in terms of that alternative view of property rights, and what do you take to be, or what are the classical German thinkers that you're examining? What do you take to be the kind of main flaws or problems with that understanding of property?
I think it'd be wrong to say that I think there are flaws with this conception of property as such. Actually, I'm sympathetic to it. I think it's more helpful to think of property as something that always does involve a relation to others. So if I have the right to something, I'm excluding someone else from the use or benefit of that thing. So even in that way, there's a relationship between me and someone else. So I think it is helpful to emphasize this sort of intersubjectivity. and the way in which with property rights is somehow a sense that there's a way of trying to determine our relations to one another in terms of what we own and how it limits the freedom of others, as well as promoting or enabling us to be free. So I think this is another thing that's distinctive in this tradition, although it may have in common with the liberal tradition that it emphasizes the importance of freedom. Again, it's not just the freedom of one person, it's taking into account the freedom of others. And I think that's really important when it comes to understanding property rights, especially today, if you think about it, that to me, it seems intuitive that some people's lack of access to resources curbs their freedom, whereas someone else's access to these resources increases his or her freedom. And it's not so much a matter of maximizing freedom. I mean, that would be compatible with some kind of consequentialist argument. Rather, it's a matter about the conditions of freedom itself, what it means to be free. And I think it's reasonable to say that property will form an important element when it comes to answering this question. It's not the only element, but it's a very important one.
Right. It seems to me that, I mean, the German thinkers are coming on the scene and becoming aware of some of the problems or issues with a new commercial society that, you know, Locke envisioned a kind of new commercial society and essentially developed a kind of view of property rights that would be suitable to it. But what the German thinkers, it seems to me, see is that there are forms of dependence that can exist even, you know, within a commercial society and require a kind of different conception of property rights than that, you know, that can realize individual freedom even within that, right? I mean, so that's kind of what I'm getting at, is the sort of the worry about the Lockean view and the concerns about the Lockean view that frame this.
Yes, yeah, so I think that's a good point. So maybe one way of understanding would be that property rights tend or can generate asymmetrical relations of dependence. So there are power differentials that come into play, and that enables one agent to dominate another agent. Now, this goes back to Rousseau, or at least, I mean, probably goes back even further, but clearly this is a theme in Rousseau's writings. And I found with Kant, there's a lot of ambiguity, because, you know, Kant was influenced by Rousseau, but sometimes it seems that Kant's not quite clear where he stands on this issue. But as we proceed, it seems to be the stance has become clearer. So I think Fichte's position is almost a radical version of Rousseau's problem, and, well, a radical solution to the problem that Rousseau identifies. Namely, you end up with a closed commercial state. And of course, with Marx, I think you can locate Marx within this tradition as well, with important differences, of course. Then Hegel seems to come down on the more on the side of a liberal right to property, but then that liberal right has to be incorporated within some broader social and political whole, which then may place limits on that right. So it's certainly not, well, even Hegel's position would be very different from a libertarian view of property rights.
Right. Yeah, this is one of the things I like very much about your book, is that it shows that that there is a German tradition here, a kind of unified account of as I thought of it, a kind of social conception of property. I don't want to call it a collective conception of property, but it may be intersubjective, as you put it, an intersubjective conception of property rather than a subjectivist conception of properties in law. But that also that there is heterogeneity within the German tradition, that they're disagreeing with one another, that they share a similar concept, but different conceptions maybe, or different forms, as you say, of the of property. So I wanted to kind of, you know, get into some of the, you know, differences. So you start with Kant. His view is, as you say, ambiguous, and it's ambiguous in a couple different ways. I thought we could start where you do with Kant's discussion of independence in the Doctrine of Right, and you know, his view of freedom or independence is different again from the kind of classical liberal tradition of Locke, and it's a relational conception at its heart. It's, you know, it's an intersubjective conception that to be independent means to be independent from power of others. On the other hand, Kant also does have a certain odd conception of that citizens can be dependent, that there's a so-called dependent citizens. So you talk a little bit about this in the book. How is it possible to have both kind of independent citizens and dependent citizens in Kant's view?
Yeah, so that did strike me as a tension in Kant's thinking. I mean, perhaps this is just a reflection of Kant's historical context and an inability to think beyond that context, perhaps. But on the other hand, I think Kant may have thought that this distinction between passive and active citizenship wasn't incompatible with his account of right, because right does seem to involve some kind of mutual limitation of what he calls external freedom. So perhaps you could have that, and then the question about how much property one owns or what one should have a right to would be an independent question that's, you know, not covered by this. So then that may be one way in which forms of dependence that are in some sense to be explained in terms of property rights are compatible with Kant's sort of very abstract conception of right itself. Where I think there is a problem, though, is that Kant's idea of an original contract seems to be something like this. We must think what we could all agree to, and what would it be reasonable for us to agree to? So it's not an actual contract, because, of course, people can enter into an agreement in which they commit themselves to things that are quite irrational. Rather, it's this kind of ideal situation in which we commit ourselves to certain things and commit others to them. So there must be some way in which everyone could accept the commitments that he or she thereby incurs. And my argument would be, well, couldn't we apply that to property rights? Would you really agree to an arrangement in which you're dependent on others by virtue of the property that you own or do not own in certain cases? So if you own only your own labor and others have the means of purchasing that labor, is that a good arrangement for you to be or to agree to? Because there you are dependent on the person who buys your labor. And so it looks like there's a kind of asymmetrical relation of dependence here that arguably would not be reasonable for one to agree to. So that's why I think that there is arguably a tension in Kant's thinking about this.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, it strikes me that one way to save him from it, and I see what you think about this, is to say something like this, that yes, certainly in the original contract, individuals can never will condition of dependence for themselves and would never will to be passive citizens, but we could will that condition temporarily, as it were, right? We can't will ourselves into being permanent servants or, you know, serfs or whatever in a political society, but we could will ourselves and we could will a society that's temporarily in that state for whatever reason, because there are sort of historical contingencies that make it difficult to sort of liberate our society immediately at this very moment. But I mean, there is that moment in the Doctrine of Right where Kant, you have to help me remember exactly what he says, but he says this, you know, so long as the passive citizens are able to work themselves up into a condition of independence or something like that. If a political society created a class that made it impossible for independence to be there, certainly on Kant's view. And I think that's even his view, that it wouldn't, that would be against right. What do you think about that? I'm not sure if that saves him.
I think there are certainly traces of that kind of argument. So there is this claim that passive citizens must be able to work themselves up to the status of active citizens. And so there may be reasons for agreeing to an arrangement in which one is initially a passive citizen, but has the chance to become an active citizen. And maybe Kant's argument would be something like, well, the state of nature is worse than a condition in which one is a passive citizen, but nevertheless has other rights, the rights that can't be disengaged from the idea of right itself as kind of the conditions of external freedom. So that may well be one argument, but I think then you do have to introduce an extra argument, and whether Kant's successful here, I think is another matter. Just doesn't seem to be obvious that it would be rational to agree to an arrangement in which you suffer various forms of domination, even if there is the opportunity for you to escape that condition of domination.
Right. I mean, he has this conception of provisional right. That is that right. I mean, that conditions can be provisionally just or right, given the qualification that society is set up in such a way that we can make progress towards the eventual realization of right. Right. I mean, so kind of like he seems to have this very, teleological, maybe say teleological view of right, that right is always in the process of coming to be, that it's never fully realizable. And hence I would read the original contract as sort of attending to the teleological character of right, right? That it could be rational to will a condition of provisional rightness as long as it's on the way towards fully rational.
Yes, I think there certainly is this teleological element. Although I must admit, it's never clear to me what the end point is, or where you would sufficiently have realized the concept of right. And maybe the distinction between passive and active citizenship is for Kant compatible with the end state, as it were. It's not as if he entertains the possibility of another form of right that transcends this one that involves the distinction between or allows the distinction between passive and active citizenship. I'm not sure there's evidence in the text of that, at least in the Rechtslehre. And when one looks at his philosophy of history, it doesn't seem to there that he's thinking in terms of transcending the condition of right that he describes in the Rechtslehre. Insofar as one does transcend it, it's to a condition of global peace, but in a way that's just a next stage, a stage added to the condition of right, or it's sort of an internal right within states.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's right. I mean, I think of that, sort of internationalization of right as part of that teleological development as well. Yeah, I can see your point. I mean, that it's a little bit Kant's ultimate view of the ideal of right is a little underdetermined, say in contrast with Fichte and Hegel. It might be that it motivated the sort of indeterminacy of Kant's view motivated them in part to become more determined about it. So yeah, we'll talk about Fichte and Hegel in a minute. I guess the last point to ask you about Kant is Kant's view of the emergence of property rights. You have a discussion of the private right from the doctrine of right, and There is this ambiguity again, and I guess I think to chalk it up again to this sort of provisional right point that I've been making. But Kant does have a view that he waffles a bit. Maybe that's the way to put it. Like, he's kind of ambiguous as to whether right comes from the sort of Lockean view of appropriating things by yourself in the state of nature versus a more intersubjective view. Maybe you want to develop that. See, you know, what kind of issues do you see there?
Well, I certainly think there is that ambiguity or even tension. How to explain it is another matter. I mean, in a way, it could be a strength of Kant's position that he's in a sense a transitional figure. Yeah, on the one hand, he is adopting the perspective of the tradition before him, a natural right tradition, which equates private right with natural right, and suggests that you could have rights in the state of nature or of a provisional kind, and then these rights just receive some kind of legal sanction, state protection once the transition to the state is made, or the civil condition, as Kant tends to refer to it. But on the other hand, there is this subjective notion of right, that somehow property rights are dependent on what some kind of general will agrees to. And in a sense, you encounter a similar tension in Rousseau, because there he talks about the alienation of all one's goods. Does that mean one gives up everything, anything to which one claims a right prior to the social contract? And then basically the social contract and the general will that follows from it decides what one actually has, which would actually, I think, be closer to Fichte's position. So I think in Kant, though, there are, you know, different strands that are actually hard to bring together. And this just may reflect that there are these different ideas that he's toying with. He's not quite sure which is the right one. But as I say, that can be a strength. It's, you know, from our position, we may say, oh, why didn't he come down on one side rather than the other, or recognize this tension and ambiguity and try to remove it? But when you're struggling with these sort of ideas and arguments, then probably it's not so easy.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, I mean, I was thinking of in terms of the provisional right point, because it does seem that at least Kant wants to say that, you know, we can come across things on our own in a kind of natural state of nature and stick our flag in the ground or whatever. That doesn't give us like decisive or perfect right property, but it may give us provisionally legitimate possession, I guess, is the distinction, a kind of a form of possession versus an actual property right. And, you know, the kind of provisionally legitimate possessions may, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, when you're setting up a political society, it's hard to do it just from scratch. It's helpful to have, you know, kinds of provisional arrangements that precede society in order to guide it. This is why, you know, I find the kind of move to sort of purge all forms of pre-political right to be a little bit concerning, right? Because if the state or whatever, or the collective is making all the decisions about property rights, then, well, I mean, those pre-political arrangements are totally null and void, yeah. Right?
So I think that may in part explain Kant's position, that he wants to have certain pre-political rights to put constraints on any kind of political arrangements. And that would be good for the reasons that you identify. Of course, there's another complication here when it comes to possession. He distinguishes between physical possession. I mean, with physical possession, it's very easy to see when there'd be a violation of your bodily integrity, for example, if you're holding something and someone forces it from you. This is going to involve some kind of physical force exercised upon you. But then Kant wants to identify right itself with this notion of intelligible possession. So, you know, I have a right to something, even if I'm not in physical possession of it. Now, how do we explain this? And that's where I think he struggles, because it's not easy to explain.
Yeah, I once tried to go through the, 120 pages of his unpublished notes on the Rex Lera, which are mostly about this problem. Yeah, I agree. I don't think he fully figured it out. Yeah, good. So let's talk about Fichte. He's much more explicit than Kant on this question about the kind of social or relational or intersubjective structure of property. He has a kind of celebrated analysis of recognition in the Foundations of Natural Right. So maybe could start by discussing Fichte's the basis of his view of property rights, and then we can kind of get into his very very kind of elaborate regulatory scheme. But maybe start by talking about the kind of foundational issues here on his view of property rights.
Yeah. So certainly with Fichte, the idea of recognition is made explicit very early on. And then how it seems to work is that we have persons, and between them they must, as it were, divide up the world between them. Now, on what basis are they going to do this? What principles will they employ? And then it seems to be in the Foundations of Natural Right, Fichte tries to identify various stages or various solutions to this problem that don't work, and then that leads on to another solution. So, for example, one way of deciding things might be to just claim this is mine and say, I have the intention to appropriate it, to use it, and so on. But then that's going to create problems, because how can one be sure that, or if there's a dispute, two people lay claim to the same thing on the same grounds, then how are you going to decide between them? And then what we end up with is the need for some third parties, namely a state, to decide such matters. But then still you have the question, well, what principle is the state going to use when allocating rights to things, to people? And then Fichte tries to come up with an argument that it would be, well, the principle would be whatever they require in order to live from their labor. This is some kind of fundamental right to live from one's labor. Therefore, you need to be allocated that which enables you to do this. And here Fichte extends the concept of property. Property to things, rather it's the right to an activity, the activity which enables you to live from your labor, and then from that activity follow certain rights to things, because there are certain things that you will need to perform that activity effectively, so that then you have a right to those things. But in a sense, the right to things is derivative from the right to an activity.
Yeah, that seems critical here, right? I mean, in contrast to the Lockean view, where the property rights are fundamentally about things, that I lay claim to a certain kind of thing in the world, Fichte's view is that I lay claim to a certain kind of activity. Maybe you could explain that a little bit. I mean, because this is, this kind of move, I mean, there does have this sort of fundamental philosophical grounding, I take it, and Fichte's distinctive view about self-consciousness and freedom, that it requires a certain kind of activity, that self-consciousness doesn't sort of hover preceding the action. There's no doer behind the deed, as it were. Like, the I only emerges in the activity. So maybe you could, you know, sort of develop that out a little bit. I take it that that's what's connected here to a certain kind of activity. But I'm also curious how Fichte gets from, you know, a certain kind of activities to a certain view of being able to make one's living through labor. Like, the connection with labor, I think, is a crucial one, because that sort of sets up his whole analysis in the closed commercial society and the way in which sort of different classes have to be very, very, you know, elaborately structured.
Yeah, so I say that the gap is filled by the following argument, that self-consciousness here is a practical form of self-consciousness. It's, if one can't become conscious of oneself as free unless one produces certain effects in the world that confirm this conception of oneself as free. And Fichte associates this with forming purposes or ends and then realizing them objectively. Now, in order for this to happen, we have to be able to interact with the world, and we do so through our own bodies. So here, self-consciousness is something that's necessarily embodied, whereas in Kant, that's not always obvious. So I think this is where Fichte does make something important explicit. And then how labor would come in here is, well, in order to able to interact with the world, we must physically survive. That's just a precondition of being any effective agency. And so you must be able to perform, engage in an activity which enables you to satisfy this very basic requirement of agency. Of course, you can't reduce agency to labor, but, you know, there is this idea that, at least within the context of right, one has to be able to interact with the world in a way that enables one to survive. So, you know, I don't want to make it sound like Hobbes, because it's not just a matter of self-preservation is what explains everything. That would be a crude account of Hobbes's position, in fact, because of course he talks about commodious living. But even then, I think Fichte's position would be very different, in that it's all this is derived just from the notion of a kind of practical self-consciousness. So the desire for preservation, something that enters the picture somewhere down the line. It's not there among the starting points of the argument.
I find this fascinating part, because as you probably know, I mean, there's a debate over the character of labor in terms of whether it's, I guess, freedom realizing or freedom conferring, or whether it's like labor kind of stinks, and it's, you know, it's an expression of our slavery, right? Like, God consigned human beings to go work the land, and that's unfree. And, you know, usually the kind of lack of freedom in labor is associated with the aristocratic tradition, and, you know, with Aristotle, you mentioned him in the book, and that to be free is to be in a condition of leisure. That when we're working, we're actually, we're sort of enslaved to the, you know, the cycles and the dynamics and the repetitive dynamics of nature. Whereas you know you get this very different view, and it comes here, I think, maybe first in Fichte, although maybe you see it a little bit earlier in Kant, that it would be way sooner, but you know, that labor is in fact actually a vehicle for freedom. It means that it's more famously cashed out in Hegel's master slave dialectic, where of course the slave comes to be free through laboring. But I'm sure if you want to, you know, sort of comment on that. I mean, of course, like, you know, a practical self-consciousness could be like an Aristotelian practical self-consciousness, becoming free through political activity rather than kind of laboring activity. that the kind of laboring activity as a distinctive vehicle for freedom seems to be crucial here, right?
Yeah, in Fichte, I'm not sure labor is a vehicle of freedom in the sense that laboring is somehow an expression of freedom, but in the way that it may be for Marx, or at least the young Marx. Rather, it seems that labor is a condition of freedom in the sense that it's not itself freedom, but we need to labor in order to satisfy the material conditions of freedom. And maybe this becomes more explicit in the 1812 Wechslehre, where he himself seems to identify genuine freedom with leisure, because he says, well, it just seems we don't have freedom, we just have necessity. And I think part of this is because when it comes to guaranteeing the right to live from one's labor, he has to introduce all these quite oppressive economic arrangements. And, you know, one might say, well, how are people free at all under such conditions? And I think then his position is, well, this is about satisfying the material conditions of freedom, but freedom itself will happen beyond labor. So in a way, it's, I mean, perhaps, you know, there might be certain forms of labor which are more compatible with freedom.
The scholar, for example. I was thinking the scholar, yeah.
Yeah, yes. So it seems that Fichte accepts in the case of the scholar, labor here coincides with what someone would be motivated to do, as it were, independently of the need to earn a living. It's just, it happens to be the same activity through which they earn a living, whereas there are other activities which it seems intuitive to think people wouldn't engage in these activities unless they had to. This doesn't seem somehow right to try and suggest that these activities are free activities in a meaningful sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's helpful. So I see you're right. It's not... because Fichte does have a strong view of a kind of justice in working. That is, that one is duty bound to work because so one not only has a right to work to make a living, but one has a duty to work, and that derives from kind of reciprocal duties to preserve the material conditions for everyone,
yes.
Right? So, everyone needs the material conditions for independence. So everyone needs to chip in, as it were.
That comes in at the level of morality or ethics rather than at the level of right. It seems that they're there.
I see. So maybe say more about that, because Fichte has some of these kind of early remarks, as you probably know, in the contribution, the correction of the public's judgment of the French Revolution. But yeah. He who does not work does not eat.
Yeah.
I mean, so you think that's a moral claim? It's not a kind of, you know, that the state could justifiably put you in jail if you're idle on the street or something.
Sometimes I think actually claims that suggest that the state would be within its rights to force people to work are to be found in the foundations of natural rights. Maybe the closed commercial state as well. So it is actually quite difficult to see where right ends and morality begins.
This has been a point you've made about Fichte.
Some of the claims certainly seem to come from the writings on morality or earlier ones, such as about the scholar's vocation, because there you have this idea of some human vocation. Everyone contributes to it by performing his or her role as a human being, but this will involve performing one's role within society, and in society there seems to be some social division of labor. But then that would again seem to be more of a moral claim than a claim about right.
Yeah, and this has been a subject of your research on Feasted for a while. It's a difficult to disintangle right from morality.
Again,
for sure
maybe there's a teleological element here
that
somehow rights are a condition of morality, and then
right.
some sense morality has an influence on right or how we understand right. You can have the very basic notion of right, which tries to abstract completely from morality. But that's not the full picture. Once you reach the stage of morality, then your understanding of right will be transformed. That you understand right in terms of morality, or something like that. Maybe that would explain how we can sort of bring together these various claims about labor.
Do you want to say anything about the extremely elaborate regulatory apparatus in Fichte's view of the state? One way to ask the question is sort of how close to, communist totalitarianism is Fichte's vision of the closed commercial state? I mean, some people, I guess, will claim that it's that the state has like total control over everything, because Fichte has this odd transformation that he starts out with a kind of social contracty type basis, but then it ends up becoming very kind of centralized regulatory command structure for the economy. How much room do you think is there in Fichte for, kind of private property, a freedom? Do you think it's quite minimal, or is there more room?
Yeah, it's complicated. So I think with private property, he talks about this absolute property. So it seems that one could say, well, we have to think of the activities through which one lives from one's labor and any things that are necessary to performing that activity as at least being administered by the state and perhaps collectively owned or whatever. It seems hard to see how they could be private property, because then individuals would be able to dispose of them freely. And then what would happen if someone couldn't live from his or her labor because he or she didn't have, wasn't assigned the right activity or wasn't allocated the things needed to perform this activity effectively? So it looks like you're going to end up with at least something like state property or whatever. But that doesn't mean that other things couldn't be private property. Why couldn't certain personal belongings be private property? And indeed, Fichte introduces this idea of absolute property. But even then, and this is an argument I try to make in the book, that absolute property might itself be a problem, because if it's private property, you can dispose of it freely, you could exchange it and so on, you could exchange it for money. And suddenly, this absolute form of property does take the form of money, according to Fichte. So you could have money to buy whatever, certain things in a basically free market that operates within this very highly regulated market. And it just seems that's going to be a problem for Fichte, because he sets up this highly regulated economy, and certain preconditions of its functioning require that the state is able to predict prices and goods in circulation and so on. And if people are free to dispose of property, that's going to have the potential to upset these calculations or introduce unforeseeable factors. So if one thinks it through, it looks like almost everything is going to have to be some form of state property, or at least property regulated by the state. There wouldn't be anything private property in the strong sense of that which we have the right to do, dispose of freely, as long as we don't thereby harm others. And whether this is sort of ends up with totalitarianism is another matter, because what does totalitarian mean? If one associates it with forms of political terror, then perhaps Fichte's state doesn't end up as a totalitarian one. But in a way, why I find it Fichte interesting is that whatever one thinks of the position he ends up with, he is in fact very consistent in his reasoning and pursuing the implications of the position he starts out with. So I think if someone is sympathetic to elements of Fichte's notion of right and the stuff about recognition and how it relates to property rights, but doesn't like what Fichte ends up with, then there's a challenge of trying to see how you can separate these two things to show that, well, actually, if we pursue the implications, then we don't end up with something like that which Fichte describes. And to be quite honest, I find it difficult to see how you would avoid ending up with this. And just in a way, I find that really interesting. It's almost as if there's a bit of a dialectic of enlightenment. Here, you start off with a position that's committed to the idea of freedom, and you pursue this commitment, and then you end up with something that doesn't seem to allow for freedom in kind of any minimal sense of meaningful sense of the term. So it's, in that sense, potentially quite interesting.
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah, I mean, thinking of this in the context of, strong egalitarian critiques of capitalism in the contemporary world. If one thinks about what exactly would be required in order to fully satisfy or realize those strong egalitarian critiques of capitalism, it would have to be a strongly regulated system. I wonder how much, this is one question I often have about Fichte, is, yeah, right, is, I guess that's one way to think about him, you didn't mean in this way, but an argumentum ad absurdum to those kinds of criticism. But I wonder if, the sort of moral underpinnings of his political economy are quite interesting to me, whereas the actual development of those moral underpinnings in his actual political economy seem to be kind of wild. And why not maybe stick with the moral underpinnings as a, kind of standing critique of private property under capitalism that requires something more. And maybe we can just chuck the closed commercial state.
Yeah, no, sure. So that, I think that would be one solution. I think it's a problem for Fichte, though, in that he seems to want to make a strong distinction between right and morality, despite what I was saying earlier about how, once we reach the moral standpoint, that may then somehow shape our understanding of right or transform our understanding of right. And I think his position seems to be, well, we have to assume what he calls universal egoism. We can't assume that people are moral agents. And that would be because being moral is essentially a matter of self-determination, but you have to choose to be self-determining. If you were coerced into adopting certain moral principles, then that would no longer be compatible with the moral standpoint. Then it would, morality would collapse into right in a way which can be enforced by means of coercion, external coercion. So I think there are reasons he has for wanting to separate right and morality. But you're right. If somehow the moral standpoint could be incorporated into the standpoint of right or one could get rid of the standpoint of right altogether, then you could have some kind of society that functions more or less how Fichte wants it to function, but without the coercion and regulation that he requires. But then it looks like it's going to be something like the type of society anarchists have in mind. We don't have legal and political institutions. These are highly cooperative societies that the dispositions of the members are such that you don't require legal norms and institutions that enforce them.
Right, which is where Fichte thinks that history might end, with a kind of, he envisions a kind of withering away of the
certainly
state.
there's, yes. But then that introduces other problems, because where he seems to hold out this prospect is in the addresses to the German nation. And there it seems, in order to foster this sense of cohesion and willingness to cooperate with others in the absence of coercion, you have to have, have this national education and so on, and so you end up more or less with the same problem in a way. But again, arguably he's being consistent here. He's saying, well, this is what we need in order to achieve this. So, you tell me how we can achieve this in another way.
Well, enter Hegel then. Maybe Hegel gives us an alternative, not quite so strongly, even though he has a quite a strong view of the state and ethical life. It's the Hegel wants to incorporate more liberal elements than you see in Fichte. Maybe we could start with those liberal elements as they appear in Hegel's view of abstract right, which is the first part of his philosophy of right. And it's where he takes over, takes up this kind of the Lockean, this sort of moment of Locke, I guess, as it were, that then gets qualified and incorporated in a more communitarian setting and in ethical life. But he does think that abstract right is an important moment of the modern state. So maybe you could talk about his view of private property in the abstract rights section, and you talk about how there's a kind of ambiguity there between two different ways to understand how Hegel conceives of abstract right, either on kind of Lockean terms, which you call the embodiment interpretation, and then kind of another way to think about abstract right in terms of what you call the recognition form interpretations. So maybe you could kind of help us through thinking about, Hegel's view of private property and where you think the right interpretation is on thinking about this.
Yeah, so with the chapter on Hegel, the earlier sections are really dedicated to trying to work out what his argument for private property in particular are, because it's not that clear. So he talks about property, and the argument here seems to be that here the free will embodies itself in things. And it must do so, because otherwise it wouldn't be free. If we were confronted by a world that limits our freedom, we wouldn't be fully free. So therefore we have to overcome this limit to our freedom by making that which is external to us, that is to say, things in the first instance, into, as it were, expressions of our own will, of our own freedom. In a way, this isn't that far from Fichte's position, because it seems that we're embodied agents who seek to realize their freedom in the world, and they do that by making the world into, as it were, an objectification of their freedom. So there I can see how a justification for property might work. But Hegel himself distinguishes between property in general and private property. So it looks like he's going to have to introduce an additional argument to justify private property in particular. And that's where I really found it difficult to see what that argument was. Now, in the Anglophone secondary literature, a dominant interpretation of this is what might be called the embodiment interpretation. So it's essentially to embody your freedom in the thing. It has to be private property, and then different reasons are provided for this. In the relevant section, I try to show why these reasons don't really show that the private property in particular is necessary. So one problem would be with the argument that in order to embody our freedom in a thing, we must have exclusive possession of that thing because someone could come along and interfere with it. But then you can come up with counterexamples where this might not be a problem, that you can embody your will in something without having exclusive ownership of it. There can be some kind of collaborative project to which everyone commits him or herself, and everyone's quite happy to make their contribution, and they can see what their contribution is. But this doesn't justify the idea that the object in question is the exclusive property of any of them. So it seems that there must be another stage to Hegel's argument. And where I think this stage is that when he moves to contract, because then it seems that he wants to say something like this: well, if I embody my freedom in a thing, okay, well, this is one stage, but that's not really an adequate embodiment of my freedom because that thing itself is not free. It's not, so it can't fully reflect my freedom. Surely it would be better if that which you encounter as an objectification of your freedom is itself free, and then so can acknowledge your freedom, and you can recognize your freedom in it, and it can recognize its freedom in you. So there's this kind of mutual recognition, which was also important to Fichte. And this, for Hegel, is true of contract, because the parties to the contract must minimally recognize one another as agents who are capable of entering into contracts, freely alienating things and so on. And contract doesn't require that I'm interested in your freedom, that your freedom matters to me, but there is a minimal sense in which I must recognize you as a free agent. And then the justification of private property would be, well, contract presupposes private property. It presupposes that I have the right to dispose of that which I alienate through a contract. So in a sense, it's only at the end, or only when we get to the stage of contract, that we can truly understand Hegel's argument for private property in particular, whereas most interpreters tend to think, well, the argument must come before contract.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, I see your point. I mean, I guess I had always been sort of inclined towards the embodiment interpretation, part because it comes earlier. But I mean, let me just to think through this. I mean, I take it one of the points that's sometimes made in the literature is that one of the things that embodying yourself in a thing in the world, one of the things that it does is it creates a kind of, it allows your arbitrary will to have a place in the world, right? That you can be a kind of distinct agent from all of the other agents that are out there in the world. That if you had a form of kind of like collective property, other agents would have a veto power on your arbitrary will or on your choices, and hence you wouldn't have a kind of complete or full embodiment of your distinctive will in the world. I think you use the example maybe of like a communal park, or something like that as a kind of example in which, you know, people could each have their own sort of place in the park and whatnot. But if I wanted to go and like throw a rock concert, you know, my part of the park, and then everybody else object to that, my arbitrary will would be, wouldn't be fully realized. I wouldn't be able to embody myself in the world.
Yeah, sure. So
what do you think?
Yeah, that's one argument one could make in defense of private property. To me, it looks like a libertarian argument. It's the idea of the veto seems to be you're making a very strong and arguably too radical claim about what it would mean to not be able to act in accordance with your own arbitrary will. It seems to make it purely arbitrary. There are no constraints on what you may do. If there is a constraint, then that's incompatible with your freedom. And this is why I think it can't be Hegel's argument, because quite clearly Hegel thinks that freedom does involve being subject to constraint. There must be some way in which we're able to reconcile the idea of freedom and constraint. Freedom for him certainly doesn't mean just being able to do what you want to do. He explicitly criticizes that notion of freedom. So if one tries to cash out the embodiment argument in that way, then I think that would quite clearly run counter to Hegel's own position.
Yeah, that's about that's
freedom. It'd just be the wrong,
right?
It'd be the wrong type of freedom, as it were. That's doing the doing the work of justification here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems right. I mean, you know, Hegel, unlike Fichte seems to proceed by, pointing out what's all the problems with views, and then kind of gradually building up to the right one. Whereas Hegel proceeds by sort of bringing out the limitations of the prior views, but still incorporating them or sublating them. So, I mean, so isn't do you think there's a kind of sublation or incorporation of that embodiment view, or do you think that plays no role then in his view of property?
Well, I think so, certainly the embodiment argument in some way plays a role, because it looks like something like the embodiment argument justifies property in general. But as I say, I think something more is needed to justify private property in particular, and that's where I think the role of contract comes in. And this, I would say, is compatible with Hegel's mode of argumentation. It's quite a unique method. So the initial position you start off with is never the final one. You always have to understand the original position as being modified by what comes later, or being filled out by what comes later. So in terms of its structure, I think the argument I make is perfectly compatible with Hegel's method and the philosophy of right. Now, to what extent private property is incorporated within this kind of broader context of right, and indeed ethical life, which comes later, that I think is one of the challenges and that Hegel himself faces, because it seems on the one hand, if abstract right is going to be a necessary moment of what he calls his system of right, then its independence must to some extent be guaranteed. It can't, there's going to be a sublation, Aufhebung in a Hegelian sense. Abstract right must be preserved. But then the question is, does that mean that private property, which he thinks he's demonstrated is justified, constrains ethical life completely? Or is there some way in which, once we reach the higher stage of ethical life, this can transform our understanding of private property and even limit private property and perhaps justify alternative forms of ownership? And that's what I try to argue for in the later sections of this chapter, that actually there are forms of property that are more compatible with the concept of ethical life itself than private property, which isn't to say Hegel has to deny the validity of private property completely. Rather, private property can form part of a mix, as it were. But still, there are other types of property that might have a higher status, precisely because they're of a more ethical nature. And I'm not sure he's willing to adopt that position. Sometimes he seems to reject any alternatives to private property. He seems to want to argue that private property is the only rational form of ownership. I'm not sure that's really consistent with his overall
right.
position, or why he needs to claim that is not obvious to me if that's what he's claiming. Some people might say he's not claiming that. But I think that he has technical support for thinking that is his position.
Yeah, I mean, certainly. I mean, one would think that the family would own property, that his ethical associations in civil society, the corporations and estates, would own property. And then finally, the state. The state has to own some property, right? It owns the territory of the which the state is located, for example. But right, I would think that those kinds of collective forms of property would exist, and then they would exist in some tension.
Yeah, so even the family, though, it looks like he's saying, well, within the context of the family, it's not private property in the strong sense. But at the same time, you know, he has this kind of patriarchal model of the family. So we have the father is the one who enters civil society, and in order to get what the family needs to survive and to live comfortably. And that will involve using the family's property. So then it looks like, well, okay, within the context of the family, it's not private property, but in relation to entities outside the family, it is private property. So this is only a sort of modification of private property. And the same would go for the corporations. There is a sense in which this property is common, but from a legal perspective, it's still private property of a particular corporation. Whereas the, what I call it, ethical property, at least I think I call it that. My memory is playing tricks on me here. But this seems to be quite different, because it's not meaningfully private property. And why it's not is because there isn't the right to dispose of it freely. That would in some sense be incompatible with the very nature of this property and how it's expressive of ethical life. Somehow, you know, there's a form of property that is expressive of the bonds uniting citizens. It has a kind of symbolic value for them in a way. So to regard it as something that could be divided up and then alienated, you know, think about privatization, for example. There may be things that, you know, many citizens would think, well, you shouldn't privatize that. It's completely inappropriate. This institution or whatever it is something that we value precisely because it's expressive of certain collective values and a sense of solidarity. And this would be undermined by privatizing it.
Yeah, that's helpful. Some public goods, for example, that can't be distributed or owned privately. Yeah, that's helpful. Let's finish up by talking about Marx, who is the final thinker that you discuss. Maybe the most famous of these thinkers, I guess, you know, to sort of non-specialists in this field, in terms of Marx's critique of private property. So maybe that's the place to begin. I mean, he's now again swinging back to more of the Fichte side of things, although has a very different account of what the kind of problems with private property are. So maybe you could, you know, kind of talk us through what Marx's critique of private property is.
Yes, well, obviously Marx is famous for critiquing private property, and you know, the assumption is that he rejects private property completely, and it, you know, that's probably true when it comes to his vision of the future. But in Capital, for example, he's clearly just presupposing capitalist society, and of course capitalist society presupposes private property. So his position, you know, historically he thinks that private property was necessary at certain historical stages, and there's this kind of big narrative about the course of history and how capitalism is a necessary historical stage, it's a precondition of communism and so on. So I don't think he could be seen to completely reject private property. Nevertheless, there is this critique of it. And I would say it's actually very difficult to work out what's going on. It's actually quite, Marx's position is very complex. For a start, it's not just a matter of private property on its own for Marx. Private property is tied up with other sort of ideas that he associates with liberalism, including, I would say, equality. And one may argue that Marx himself is an egalitarian, and this may be true in a certain sense, but I don't think his critique of private property is based on any kind of egalitarian commitments. Rather, he's in the tradition of Kant, Fichte, and Hegel, in that freedom is the main value, if you like. There's a certain understanding of freedom. It's different from the liberal conception of freedom. So one thing I struggled with was trying to work out precisely why it's necessary to abolish private property completely. Because one might say, well, to solve the problems that Marx identifies, all you need to do is abolish private property in the means of production. And then, the problem is solved, but there could be other forms of private property. And it seems hard to think why people couldn't have private property and personal belongings, for example. And so I'm not sure Marx himself is really committed to abolishing private property completely. And even if he is, why he has to be committed to it. But I think there is another argument or idea at work in Marx, and this connects private property with equality. Namely, that he thinks that a certain liberal idea of equality is really to be explained in the dominance of exchange value in capitalist society, that you have this notion of value which is necessarily abstract and involves abstracting from all the particular qualities of things and just understands things in terms of their you know, basically units of money. And so there's this idea of having to abstract from anything particular. And I think he sees the liberal idea of equality as a reflection of this, in the sense that the liberal idea of equality involves abstracting from all those things that make us into the individuals that we are. And then this can be problematic because some of these things may be sort of highly significant, such as, you know, social class and so on. So we have this kind of idealized, very abstract notion of equality, which is itself a reflection of the dominance of exchange value in communist society, sorry, in capitalist society. So one argument I try to make is that this would explain why private property more generally, not just private property in the means of production, might need to be abolished, because if you have other forms of property, you'll still have abstract exchange value, which explains this abstract conception of equality, which Marx finds equally problematic. So in order to get rid of that, in a way, you've got to abolish exchange value completely, and that this will require the abolition of private property. That is, you know, things that we can exchange merely with a view to their kind of value that they have that can be expressed in monetary terms. And you know, this ties in, I think, with later strands in Hegelian Marxism. So I mentioned Adorno, for example. So I think that there are passages in Adorno which express this quite well. So that's where I think it's really complicated with Marx. There seem to be all these different ideas in play, and it's how do you connect them in such a way that you end up with a coherent theory. So in retrospect, I probably began by thinking Marx might be the easiest one to deal with because his position is relatively unambiguous when it comes to private property. But it actually, you know, it turned into one of the most complicated chapters in a way.
Yeah, well, that's but it's also helpful in the sense of it strikes me, and you're listening to your very persuasive analysis, reading it, that there is a strong connection back to this tradition that you've been discussing, back through Fichte and especially back through Rousseau. I think one thinks of Rousseau's worries about the homogenizing effect of, you know, Enlightenment universalism. You know, say, for example, in his Government of Poland, where he just, you know, there's no longer any Frenchmen or Englishmen. It's just everybody's Europeans, right? I mean, there's this worry about the institutions of modern Enlightenment life can actually start to efface the differences or distinctions that make us individuals. And I think that's a view that goes through Fichte then with his worries about universal commerce and the way in which universal commerce tends to face the distinctions among nations and what we talked about a minute ago with the Fichte's importance of national self-consciousness to create a kind of distinctive identity. So, I mean, is that the right kind of connections back to draw? I mean, on Marx's heritage here?
Yeah. Yes, I think one can draw those connections. So, an interesting thing about Marx, I would say, is that typically private property is justified in terms of how it enables us to be individuals, or it's important to being somehow an important part of being an individual is to have private property, whereas Marx in a way turns that on its head. Private property is not conducive to being an individual, rather it's sort of undermines our individuality.
And yeah, that's great.
I think here this brings me back to this thing about exchange values. It's hard for me here to give an overview of the argument, but that's where I think it comes in, because it seems to be the kind of connecting thread here, that there's somehow there's this dominance of exchange value, which is a necessary feature of capitalist society. This then finds expression in this kind of abstract notion of equality, which is incompatible with our sense of ourselves as individuals. And actually, I think there's an interesting idea which Adorno, I think, expresses, but you know, it's obviously can be traced back to Marx, is that once one has this abstract notion of equality that involves abstracting from the our particular attributes and so on, we can think of these attributes themselves as commodities, as something detachable from ourselves in a way that we wouldn't do otherwise. You know, the natural way would be to think of these as attributes that are somehow bound up with us. They're not something we can detach. But once you start thinking of them as things that you can abstract from yourself, and you just regard yourself as an abstract legal or moral entity, then they seem to be something that are in some sense external to oneself, or can be made external to oneself. And that might encourage one to think of, talents that one has as not really parts of what one is, but rather something that you can take to the market, and they can be measured in terms of their abstract exchange value.
That's great. So last question, just thinking back over this tradition as a whole, I was curious as to your view of what kind of contribution, I think, do you consider this? What's the significance, I guess, another way to put it, of this tradition as a whole for, say, contemporary political philosophy or contemporary politics? What do you think the kind of value added is for this tradition in helping us think through the problem of property?
Well, on the one hand, I'm reluctant to try and draw lessons from the history of philosophy. I think we can, but it needs to be left up to the reader rather than me coming up with all these kind of prescriptions or drawing these sort of very general conclusions. On the other hand, one thing I try to do with the book is to show that, you know, the philosophers in question really engaged with the concept of property. And, you know, whatever we may think of their conclusions, there is really this rigorous engagement with the concept of property. And maybe one thing we can learn from it is that it's very hard to justify one form of property to the exclusion of any others. So really the better position would be to think, well, there are different forms of property that can be justified. And which ones we adopt may depend on various factors. It could be, you know, historical factors. So for example, something that may have needed for some reason to be private property at one point in time may at a later historical stage be more, maybe something that it'd be better for it to be some form of common or collective property, or even, you know, vice versa. So there may be historical conditions, but also, you know, about what kind of society we want, what function property performs within a society. Now, I think there is a common thread with these philosophers. Property is always discussed in connection with freedom. So we can ask, well, what does it mean to be free, and how is property going to, what role will property play, you know, given the conception of freedom that we have? And of course, you can have different conceptions of freedom. We don't need to have one exclusive notion of freedom. This is a problem I find with the libertarians. Accounts is just very reductive, and I think this is why they end up with the privileging private property, not seeming to entertain the prospect of the justifiability of other forms of ownership. So maybe these are, you know, the how we can apply it to sort of modern day concerns. It's just you know, certainly I live in a society in which private property is considered to be the kind of default form of property. But maybe, you know, if we look at this tradition, then this assumption will be challenged.
Well, David, this has been a great conversation, and I very much enjoyed it. So thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Yeah, my pleasure.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.